David Ross is coming to the plate in his final year. One of the real good guys in baseball, wearing a microphone for us tonight. Listen in.
Check, see if it's on. Mic check, 1, 2.
Mic check, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 2. This is Freddie Freeman. Hello.
I got what doctors like to call a little bit of a lower half weight problem. My ankles are about as big as your freaking calves. My ankles are like this big. So I got some cankles.
This is fun, huh?
So stressed out. It's like once I get to play, I'm fine. But before, this guy's slider is filthy.
On this week's episode of A Swing and a Belt, former catcher David Ross relives his fairy tale 2016 season, which culminated in some huge moments on the way to the Cubs winning the World Series. Another former catcher, Ray Fosse, reminisces about the great Oakland A's teams of the early 70s, and Ben finds out what a day on the job is like for Blue Jays first base and outfield coach Tim Leaper. But first, Freddie Freeman is finally getting the attention he deserves as one of baseball's top talents. He's on his way to the All-Star game, and with the Braves in contention this season, Freeman is being mentioned as a possible MVP candidate in the National League. Freeman was born and raised in California, but has deep Canadian roots. Both of his parents were born in Canada, and after his mom passed when he was only 10 years old, Freeman hoped to one day honor her memory by representing Canada in competition. And last year, at the World Baseball Classic, Freeman got his chance.
It's about time for Freeman to rip one into that big area in left center field.
Hit in the air, deep to left center, on his horse, Broxton. Looks up, it is gone for Freddie Freeman.
Not the last high fly, deep to right, back is Anderson, looking up and waving goodbye. Off the facing of the second deck, it's a bomb to right center for Freddie Freeman. He is now 6-for-9 with 2 home runs, 3 RBIs in the series, and the Braves lead it 1-0. That ball absolutely destroyed by Freeman.
Freddie, thanks very much for the time. Tell me a little bit what it meant to you to suit up for Canada, the WBC.
That's probably one of my favorite all-time baseball memories I'm ever going to have. I kind of live my life trying to honor my mother in any kind of way possible, and I thought playing for Canada would be the greatest honor I could give her. It was an emotional time for not only me, but my whole family. My dad was in the stands. I don't think he even envisioned one of his sons ever putting on a Canadian uniform. So that first game against the Dominican when no Canada played and I was standing out there, it was pretty an emotional time for me, but I knew she was there with me, and it's something I'll never forget.
It's funny because Canadians take great pride in people representing Canada, but this kind of snuck up on a lot of us up here. I don't think a lot of people up here knew that your parents were Canadian. When you joined the team for the WBC, were there guys in the clubhouse who were like, what are you doing here, man?
Yeah, a lot of them were, and they wanted me to sing O Canada to see if I knew the words and stuff like that. But we had a great time. One of my favorite weeks of all. You know, hopefully next time, if they ask me to play a game, we'll get to play more than one week. But they were giving me a little ride on the bus, mostly more no, you know, but totally understand. I get it. But I think there was another one, Chapman. He was less Canadian than me, so I kept throwing that one out to make them go somewhere else instead of getting on me.
I heard your dad was down on the field a little bit for BP. I mean, as a dad, he just must have, from a number of different angles, this must have been special for him.
I think so. My dad is not one to probably talk about emotional things, but he will talk your ear off about other things. But you could see he was beaming with pride to have one of his sons, I think, represent where he came from and not only his wife's but my mother's country too. I think he could tell how much it meant to me, and it made it mean that much more to him. Having him there with me was probably made that moment that much better.
So when you come to Toronto, which is most years the way it works out with the Braves and Blue Jays, I mean, do you have spots here? Is this kind of like a home away from home for you?
It's a little bit. My mom used to work in downtown Toronto, and my dad would wait in downtown Toronto to wait for her to get done with work. And so he's told me a little bit about some stuff, but I've never had him here with me. So I don't know exactly where all that stuff is, and I want him to come, but it seems like we always come here for the 2-2s, so we don't have that much time. So I'm waiting for a 3-game series, and I want my dad to come up with me, and he can show me everything, and I know exactly where my mom was and where he was and all that kind of stuff. But just stepping off that plane and going through customs, it's a special time for me because I know this is where my family's from.
I haven't been to your ballpark or your clubhouse this year, but I understand there's some sort of Canada baseball cap in your locker. What's the story behind that?
So I have a iHeart Canada trucker hat just sitting on my in my locker, and it hangs there every single day. I never take it down. Like I said, everything I do is for my mother, pretty much. I wear sleeves every game because she died of melanoma skin cancer, and it's just the little thing I do to show that I'm protecting my skin. I do everything I possibly can just to honor her, and when I walk into the clubhouse every day at home, I see iHeart Canada just so I know I don't forget her.
It's great stuff. Let's talk about a Canadian on your team, Mike Soroka from Calgary. No-hitter into the seventh in his fourth start. Pitches here in Toronto, got to be a lot of emotion. How good is this kid?
He's a special talent. He really is. You would never know he's 20 years old. The way he carries himself, the way he pitches on the mound, we got lucky. We really did. I don't know how you can pitch in front of your family and your home country, and I thought he did pretty well yesterday. I think everybody's first start when they in front of family and friends, it's always a little tough. You know, when I went home and played in 2011 in Anaheim with my whole family there, I think I went 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. I was just so nervous. So he's got an incredible high ceiling, and he's just getting started, and we're lucky to have him.
Having been through some lean years recently, how exciting is it for you? I don't want to treat you like you're a 38-year-old. You're a 28-year-old, but you've been here a while. How exciting is it for you to see what's going on right now?
It's incredible. Like I've said, you know, everybody wants to be Derek Jeter and go to the playoffs every single year, but that wasn't the case for my career, and the last 3 years have been tough. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but I have always said the rise back up from the down is always going to be a lot sweeter, and I don't think anybody picked us this year, and here we are, people chasing us. We got a lot of guys that don't have the back of the baseball cards. That's why people didn't pick us, but we got incredible talent, incredible young guys. So I think we're not going anywhere.
Continued success. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Dan.
Sportsnet has Canada's team covered.
How about that?
All access, all the time. Sportsnet, the exclusive home of everything Blue Jays.
The backup catcher isn't generally a guy who gets a lot of attention, but David Ross was one of those guys as a player that everybody seemed to admire and respect and love. And he finished his playing career as a member of the Chicago Cubs, and his timing couldn't have been better. His last year was 2016, when the Cubs won the World Series for the first time in over a century. And man, did Ross have his moments along the way.
Ross cracks one in the air, deep left field, 100 home runs for David Ross.
David, don't you want to go?
3-run homer, Cubs lead 5-1. A smiling David Ross rounding third. As he said a few weeks ago, 100 home runs in the show would be very cool. He is enjoying that moment right now.
Chicago. I said, come on.
David, there are so many good guys and good stories in the game, but your story is so interesting to me because I know you feel truly blessed to have had the career that you've had and to have enjoyed the success that you've had. You won 2 World Series, and I want to focus mostly on those World Series and specifically 2016. But you wind up in Chicago before 2015, the same time John Lester goes there. Not a coincidence. And that kind of leads through the story. In that offseason, when you were being talked to by the Cubs, was it an automatic for you that you were going to go where Lester was going and you were going to wind up playing on the north side of Chicago?
Well, I was watching where Lester went for sure and with our history. But I was trying to – I knew it was going to be my last contract. And I was trying to, you know, do what was best for my family, get as much money as I possibly could and win. It came down basically to either going back to the Red Sox – going to Chicago or San Diego. San Diego was kind of a wild card there and kind of was making a push when they made the Matt Kemp trade and all that stuff was going down. But luckily made a great decision, and the Cubs gave me 2 years, and we definitely needed that last year to push to 16. And it was just so familiar to me to go somewhere where I knew the guy I was going to catch. We had played the Cubs the year before in 14 in Boston, and they kicked our tail, and I saw firsthand Jake Arrieta almost no hit us, and I was in that game probably the most dominant I had seen or felt as a hitter against any pitcher, and they had some good young bats, so it was one of those things that I kind of knew this team was up and coming.
Was the experience of being a Cub similar to the experience of being a Red Sox? I mean, you played for two of the most iconic franchises. You won a World Series with each. How did the two compare?
Yeah, no doubt. I think Theo had brought a lot of the same aspects of the two organizations when I came from Boston. When I first went to Boston, I need to say, that's when I first saw what a winning organization looked like, how they treated the players. Everything was taken off your plate. Family was taken care of. Travel was the best. Hotels were the best. Everything was top-notch. All you had to worry about was playing, and that's what Boston showed me, and I learned in Boston what winning was like, and I was able to come over to Chicago, where just like Boston, everybody knows your name in the city, you're a rock star, there's high expectations, and with Theo and Jed and that front office, there are a lot of high expectations on the field too.
So you guys are good in 2015, but as you say, it takes until 2016 to get over the hump, win the World Series, and you had two of, I think, the greatest moments, and I'm not just saying this because I'm sitting here with you right now, two of the greatest moments I think any player's ever had, and I was just lucky and fortunate enough to be in the ballpark for both. The first one is one that maybe is not as well known as it was to the people who were there. It was a Sunday night baseball game. It was the last home game of the regular season for the Cubs, and you had already clinched everything you needed to clinch. You're playing the Cardinals, and it's the seventh inning, and you're catching. You've hit a home run already in that game. You've already gotten an enormous standing ovation, and Joe Maddon comes out on the top of the seventh at Wrigley to make what looks like a pitching change, because that's what happens every single time a manager comes out. But unbeknownst to you or anybody in the ballpark, he wanted to get you one more ovation. He didn't make a pitching change. He made a catching change and took you out of the game. What did he say to you? How did you realize out on the mound exactly what was going on?
Well, I'm getting chills just thinking about that. And I remember that home run like it was yesterday, and you guys caught. Probably have watched that more than I've watched the World Series.
They love David Ross here in Chicago. Look what he just did. Look what he just did.
Stop! David Ross gives the Cubs the lead in the fifth. Wow. I've got goosebumps. I don't know about you, Ron.
I'm tempted to look around for the movie cameras because things like this only happen in Hollywood.
Acknowledges the fans. Oh, what a moment.
That last game in Chicago for me was maybe one of the best moments of my baseball career. He's walking out, and I see the team start coming in. I'm looking at John out on the mound, and I look over, and here comes Joe out of the dugout, nice and slow. And I'm thinking, what is he doing? John Lester's dealing right now. Is he kidding me? You know, like, he better not be I'm getting my whole veteran getting mad and just my poopy pants on, I guess you could say. And
Joe is talking with both David Ross and John Lester.
Yeah, he comes out, and he looks right at me and goes, well, you're not going to like me for this, but I'm taking you out of the game.
Is Ross coming out?
Is he going to get Ross one more ovation? How about that?
Great move by Joe Maddon. Beautiful. David Ross gets a standing ovation. All of his teammates in the dugout give him a big bear hug. Ross visibly emotional. Ross makes a curtain call in full catcher's gear.
And I looked at him, and then I looked at John, and then I looked at all the players start patting me on the back, and I'm still kind of dumbfounded. And, you know, I don't want to get emotional now on the show, but it was like one of those cool, I had to pull my mask down, almost started crying, started welling up. I saw Wilson Contreras coming out of the dugout to pick me up, and everybody started hugging me and patting me on the back. It was one of the coolest things ever, and I got like three standing ovations, hugged all my teammates and coaches. It was a really cool moment that I can picture it right now in my mind. It's so clear. It was, like you said, one of the coolest things ever happened to anybody.
It was really great. It was a year-long love affair, really, that existed between you and Cubs fans. And they saw how special you were, not only when you caught Lester, not only that you hit 10 home runs that year, but what you did for the young players and with the crowd as well. So that leads into October, and you guys get to the World Series, and you're playing the Indians. And I may be wrong here, but I think a lot of people forget you guys were down 3-1 in that series. They remember Game 7, but you had to fight back from down 3-1 to win it and win Game 6 and 7 in Cleveland. When you were down 3-1, what was the confidence like that you guys could still win the World Series?
Well, I remember coming in after that third loss, and we were in Chicago, and the city had been a buzz. And from a backup player and a guy who only caught John Lester, I couldn't wait for Game 5 because I knew I was going to get to start at Wrigley Field, my last game ever at that field, and it was in the World Series. So I was super jacked up about that and the energy that the Cubs fans have been bringing. So, but I remember walking after that third loss, and I don't remember who it was. Somebody threw their glove in disgust in their locker, and I turn around and just said, hey, man, we're not going to do that. And I was looking forward to my start. So I was like, hey, we're not going to do that. We're not going to pout. We're not. There's so many people that would trade places with us right now to be able to put this uniform on, play in a World Series at Wrigley Field. And I was cherishing that, so I didn't want anybody else to rain on my parade and bring that bad energy, you know, that negative energy that can be brought. So I don't know if that had any kind of doings, but we came out the next day. We fought. Johnny pitched great. I got a nice sack fly.
And the 2-2. Fly ball, left field. It is playable for Santana, but it's deep enough. Tagging is Zobrist. He comes in to score. David Ross with a sacrifice fly. Cubs lead 3-1.
Went in 3-2, and I knew if we could just get over that hump and get back to Cleveland, we had a shock. We had Jake going the next day, and he had thrown well for us, Jake Arrieta. And so it was a lot of confidence. We had Halloween the next day, an off day. We got to spend in Chicago trick-or-treating with our family. I thought that was a nice reset for us as a team. And then went over. We dressed in our Halloween costumes and flew over to Cleveland. But I had a lot of faith. It just came down to our starting pitching. Cleveland was really good, and their starting pitchers had been really good to that point.
What was your costume on the plane?
I was a Kyle Schwarber fan. I was decked out in all my Kyle Schwarber gear. I walked around. It was kind of cold. All my kids, my son was I think he was Black Panther, and my daughter, I forget what she was. I don't even remember, but it was a fun day.
So you win game six, you get to game seven. Kyle Hendricks is on the mound. He gets into the fifth inning, I believe, and then again, John Lester comes back into the story. And Joe Maddon had basically said, there are only three pitchers I want to use today, Hendricks, Lester, Chapman. That's it. So Lester comes into the game, and you come into the game in the middle of game seven. Had you been kind of teed up before the game by Joe to say, hey, if I make one move, I'm making two moves?
Yeah, Joe had told me the night before, my plan is to bring you in with Lester. I plan on using Johnny, and told me the night before and the day of. That's still the plan. We came in the fifth. Craziness happened. Swing and bunt by Kipnis, which I thought was a good matchup. Joe brought him in. Kipnis hadn't done anything off John. Swing and bunt, and I threw it in the stands, second, third, and then two pitches later, a breaking ball in the dirt. John really wanted to make sure he bounced it, threw a little short, hit me off the mask. I trip over myself, two runs score. Craziness happens, and I'm thinking, man, we had the curse of the goats and the cats, and now it's going to be the curse of David Ross coming in the game. I'm like, I'm supposed to be run prevention, you know. So luckily, I regrouped and got in there and then hit probably one of the biggest home runs of my career off Andrew Miller. And that at bat was so fresh in my mind. And I had watched a lot of video on him and was trying to calm my nerves, swinging all over the place. And then finally took a fastball up in a way that I saw well and knew that he shooked a lot of fastballs. The next pitch he shooked a fastball, and I got good wood on it, and it went out to center. And
1-2, and a swing and a high fly ball well hit to deep center. Davis is back. Davis at the wall. It's good.
Rajay Davis was sizing it up as he goes back, and I'm thinking, this is not going to happen. If he robs me right now, I'm running right out the tunnel and right.
David Ross just homered to straightaway center field off Andrew Miller. 6-3 Cubs.
And then we go on to what's that wild game, and Chapman comes in, and Rajay hits that big three-run homer, and they tie it up. And, you know, I've never been so, like, mentally – I'm usually a pretty positive person and can turn the page, but I was mentally beat for at least an inning or an inning and a half. I felt like that home run just crushed me, and I couldn't get those negative thoughts out of my mind. And luckily, Jason Hayward – we had that rain delay, and Hayward regrouped us, and guys came out swinging.
At that point, up until you took Miller deep, he was the unhittable guy. I mean, nobody had done anything against him. How do you go up to the plate being as confident as you need to be when a guy's just wiping people out the way that he was?
Yeah, he was, and he was probably the best pitcher in baseball, like you said, to that point. I went up, and I had watched some film, like I said, and I was like, okay, calm your nerve, just see a strike. And first pitch, he throws me back foot slider. I swing over. It's not even close to being a strike. I swing over it. I can't calm myself, my nerves, my energy. And then the next pitch, I was like, all right, you got to take one and just see, calm, you know, see the baseball. And he threw me a slider right down the middle. And I'm like, I'm 0-2 off Andrew Miller. The things are not looking good. And so I went to my two-strike approach, which I had done all year, and I had some success and actually hit probably more home runs from my two-strike approach that year than ever before. And he threw me a fastball up and away, and I saw it really well right out of his hand. And I was like, okay, good. You saw the baseball. Let's have an at-bat. Just try to put the ball in play. And choked up, and he shook. I had seen him shake a lot on video I had watched to the fastball. I know him from our time in Boston, 2 years in Boston. His main pitch is a slider. I was thinking, if I'm a catcher, I'm throwing the slider. So I sold out to fastball, and he threw it down where I put some good wood on it. But, yeah, it's one of those, you take Andrew Miller deep, you don't ever forget that.
You walked later on, were taken out for a pinch runner. There were three catchers on the roster. The Cubs win the World Series. But you homered in your last official home at bat in the regular season. You homered in Game 7 of the World Series in your last ever official Major League at bat. And you go out on top, winning the World Series, big part of the parade in Chicago a couple of days later. I mean, this is a Disney movie, man. 2016 must feel like a fairy tale to you.
It's unbelievable when I look back on all the great things that happened to me. I mean, we talk about World Series Game 5. Eddie Vedder gave me a shout-out at the for the seventh inning stretch.
Look at this. Look at you. Wrigleyville is full. It's October 30th, and there's baseball at Wrigley Field for the first time in history. I know we want to thank Theo and Tom and Joe and the team for bringing the World Series to Wrigley Field 2016. And there's one guy in particular I want to sing my ass for, and he's number 3. He's behind the plate. He may retire, but he'll never quit. Mr. David Ross, I'd like to belt this one out for you. It's his last game at Wrigley. Let's sing it for him. Let's sing it with Harry.
My teammates carried me off the field of probably one of the biggest World Series games ever. What a cool thing that is. And a lot of people ask me about, you know, why were you so important to that team? I don't know. I was just a piece to a big puzzle. But what my teammates said about me in the media, to the reporters and to the fans, which the media portrays, is they said all these great things about me. And so the city fell in love with me. I got all these great ovations and great things happened to me. I caught a no-hitter from Jake Arrieta that year. I was on just this fairy tale ride and took advantage of so many great opportunities that came my way and did some things that I'd never done before. So I went into it with an open mindset and things just happened to work out. I do feel blessed and so thankful for all that happened to me, but comes from a lot from a great group of guys, a great coaching staff, and a great city and organization.
Well, you're always humble, but you were a big, big part of everything that happened to the Cubs. It happened to you, but you made your own opportunities as well. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Dan.
We love you.
Looking to stream the Blue Jays this season? Sportsnet Now might be the product for you. Available to anyone in Canada over the internet, Sportsnet Now gives you 24/7 access to Sportsnet channels as well as content not available on TV. You can stream on the go or at home on your big screen from the most popular devices, including smartphones and tablets, Xbox, Chromecast, and the Apple TV app. Simply say, "Hey Siri, play the Blue Jays game."
You can catch the Blue Jays Yankees game on Rogers Sportsnet.
Sign up for as long as you want and cancel whenever you'd like. And it's free for Sportsnet TV subscribers. Plus, in addition to the Blue Jays, you also get Blue Jays Central, Jays in 30, and much more. Visit snnow.ca for more details. There are some guys, when you meet them along the way, you look at them and you just say, man, that was a ball player right there. And Ray Fosse is one of those guys, a very good catcher with the Indians and the A's in his major league career, late 60s and into the 70s. He was really as tough as they came and was a part of two World Series champions with the Oakland A's, a great group that featured some of the most talented and colorful players that baseball has ever seen. A lot to talk about with Ray Fosse. Ray, a bunch of things I want to ask you. You were part of one of the most interesting, successful teams in baseball history, the A's of the 70s. But if we go a little bit further back, I didn't realize you were part of the first ever MLB draft. First round pick, seventh overall, 1965. In 1965, how does a young baseball player find out that he's been drafted?
Well, first of all, I was upset because it cost me a lot of money because they started a draft in 65 to eliminate bonuses. And you could sign with anybody prior to 65. Well, they started the draft to say that. Now they're giving millions away, you know, in the same draft choices. So it's changed a little bit. But actually, I was there was a lot of talk that I would be drafted. Actually, I was telling some guys the other day that I was asked not to play football, which I played football, basketball, and baseball in high school. They said, don't play football because you're going to be drafted. You might get hurt. I said, I can get hurt walking down the street. So I continued to play, realizing later that it is a contact sport in baseball, even though people don't think that. But I was part of a group of about four teams that scouted me. And actually, Walter Shannon never saw me play, but he got information through a combine of four or five teams that said he was with the Indians, Walter Shannon was. And they said, you know, this guy, maybe you need a catcher, maybe this is the guy. So Walter Shannon, when the Indians drafted me, he came to my hometown in Marion, Illinois. I had my high school baseball coach, an attorney was there. And the funny thing, whenever they were talking, all I wanted to do was play baseball since I was in third grade. I said, I'm going to hitchhike to Florida and sign with the Cardinals because I was a big Cardinal fan. But at the time, Walter Shannon was there, and all of a sudden he leaves. And I'm going, where'd he go? So, well, we didn't come to an agreement. I said, what do you mean? Let's go. Get him back here. I don't care. Just let me sign. I want to play. And but I did sign, and you know, the rest was history. But the funny thing, how it's reported to get all this huge money. And I ended up getting $28,000 plus a progressive bonus, $7,500, you know, based on, and then college and all that. I said, listen, I'm going to go to college in the off season, but I'm not going to go as a baseball player. So I ended up taking the $35,000. But the real funny thing, our math teacher in high school, Mrs. Mann, I'll never forget it. She called me reading a sports page in the back of class. She said, Ray Fossey, put down that sports page. You'll never make any money in baseball. And the funny thing, I couldn't wait to see her when the spring season was over in 65. And she said, you stay in baseball. There's a lot of money there. You know? And, you know, and I don't know. I haven't seen her. I don't know if she's still alive. But if she could see the salaries today, right, she would really think that. But it was something, Dan, that I always wanted to do. I always wanted to play baseball. And once I got that opportunity to be drafted, and I didn't care, just give me a chance to play baseball. I don't care. And obviously the money would have been great considering my mother raised three of us. But the bottom line, I got a chance to play, and that's kind of how it – I said, who's Walter Shannon? Said, well, he's with Cleveland. I've never seen him. So, well, he's the one that's going to come to try to sign you, and ultimately ended up doing it.
You had some really good years with Cleveland, two-time All-Star, two Gold Gloves. You go to Oakland just after they've won the first of three in a row in 72, but you're there for World Series championships in 73 and 74. Bando, Rudy, Vida Blue, Catfish, Reggie. When you think about that group, what comes to mind?
First of all, shock, because I was 10 days ago in spring training and I was traded. And I'll be honest with you, I'm probably one of maybe two or three players who never wanted to be traded from Cleveland because it was my first organization. And you have to realize I grew up collecting baseball cards, and Stan Musial was my guy. And that was before free agency. So I saw Stan Musial stay with the Cardinals his whole career. Al Kaline, all these great players. So I thought that if I signed with Cleveland, that's the team I wanted to play with my whole life, my whole career. I think Dwayne Kuiper was the only other guy that didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be traded, and we both traded to the West Coast. We ended up being broadcasters. But long story short, I was traded. I'll never forget showing up at spring training, and Charlie Finley had said, come up there, I want you to take pictures. Dick Williams said, to heck with pitchers. You have 10 days to learn his pitching staff. And I caught Catfish my first game in exhibition, and Dan, he threw five innings of baseball. I didn't break a sweat.
Jim Catfish Hunter, 14 wins, 8 losses, started the season with a quick victory getaway, then went into a mysterious slump, and then bounced back. He has a 6-game winning streak now. He's not lost since June 16th when the Yankees beat him. And an earned run average of 2.63. 3 years in a row, he's won over 20 games. And when the A's need him in that fifth game of the playoffs, or in that seventh, or that big game in the World Series, he's the man that's done it for him.
Most unbelievable strike throw I've ever seen in my life. You know, and I thought, well, they just won last year. And then I get traded. I figured it's not going to happen. But Dick Green told me around the batting cage, I said, Greeny, you guys just like you don't care. And he says, no, we care. He said, we're going to win our division. We're going to play somebody from the East. We're going to beat them. We're going to go to the World Series and beat them. We're going to be world champions. What?
The Oakland A's have won their second consecutive World Series championship. The first time that's been done since the Yankees of 62 and 63.
I just left Cleveland. Guys could barely throw strikes. And here I'm talking about hearing this guy talk about a world championship. And it turned out to be exactly that way for him, for our ball club in 73, 74 to do it again, three consecutive. And I was fortunate to be a part of two of them.
Ken Holtzman in 73 threw over 290 innings. Catfish Hunter in 74 threw 318 innings before the playoffs. How did guys do that then when now 200 is seen like a big number?
I think it's all about being trained. Remember, that was a four-man rotation. It was so great because it was a routine. But I think those guys, they were just so good. I mean, in Vida and Catfish and Raleigh out of the bullpen. You know, in 74 World Series, game one, first of all, we only had 9 pitchers on the staff, only used 5 in a 5-game World Series.
Kenny Holzman pitched 4 1/3 the first game. Raleigh came in 4 1/3. And Catfish pitched the third, got the final out, struck out Joe Ferguson.
2-2 to Fergie, two out. Ninth inning, 3-2 Oakland. Pashorek at first. Got him, and that'll do it. As the Catfish comes in and strikes out Joe Ferguson, and the Dodgers in the ninth inning settle for one run.
And Dan, I did not know until about 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, this is a long time. Wes Stock, who was our pitching coach, we were in Seattle, and I said something about him. He said, you know what happened? I said, no, I saw Catfish warming the bullpen. I thought he was just thrown in between starts because he finished in Baltimore. He said, no, Alvin Dark said, I need somebody to get the final out because Raleigh, you know, is a closer, 4 1/3. Catfish tapped Alvin on the shoulder and said, I can get that last out. So at Dodger Stadium, which you're familiar with, you go underneath and you go to the bullpen. I'm catching. I'm seeing him warming up. Alvin comes out and he points, what are you talking about? That's Catfish, you know. But he came in and struck out. But that's the way Catfish was. You know, so he gets a save in game one of the World Series. But between Holtzman and Vida and Catfish and Blue Moon, these guys, it was so great because there was a routine. And someone, I can't remember in 69 or 70, you have to start in the minor leagues. And I want to say somebody from the Mets started a five-man, saying that, you know, four-man's going to be too tired. But, Dan, I think the bottom line, first of all, I'd like to see them say 7-3 is a quality start. You go 6-3, that's a 4.5 ERA. What's quality about that? But I think if they went 7-3, that you would see pitchers going, hey, I got to go 7 because my agent says I need to go 7 to have a quality start. Gaylord Perry, I caught in 72, 342 innings. In 40 starts, 40 decisions, Dan, 24-16 with one saved. Ken Aspromonte called him out of the stands, say, hey, I need you. He goes to the bullpen in Kansas City, saves the game. But 29 complete games, it's unheard of. You don't have that many all throughout baseball in a season, much less one guy. But I think it's all about conditioning, training. Having a four-man rotation, to me, was great because it was a routine. These guys today are in much better shape than any of us ever were back in those years. But it's all about training. You train for 100 pitches, what's going to happen at 80? Do you start to decline? Why not say 140, and then as you get 100 and 110, you're out. But you're training for whatever you're doing. And I think that's kind of a deterrent of the game. But, you know, money is so great, they protect the guys because they don't want to lose their investment. And, you know, we didn't make a lot of money back in the days.
Right.
But, you know, our bonus was a World Series check, which unfortunately, unlike today, it's $300. It's $25,000, $30,000 back then.
Did you have a winter job when you were playing Major League Ball?
We all had winter jobs. I mean, we had to work because when I played in the All-Star game in 70, I was making $7,000. And I got a $5,000 bonus for playing in the All-Star game. So I'm making 12 grand. Yeah, I worked every offseason. And you know what I think, too, Dan, in today's world, because the minimum was, what, 525, 530. You think about the money that players are making. And listen, I'm happy for them. But what I think takes away from is that God gives us this body when we're born, but I don't think he ever intended us to work it out every day. And I think in the offseason, because money is there and players don't have to work, their body doesn't rest. And as a result, they start playing the game and it breaks down. When I worked, whether it's in real estate or stocking grocery shelves, I mean, I did anything and everything to make a buck. And that's something that does not have to be done today. And I think I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being able to sit here and talk to you because a lot of things with social media, guys can't do that.
Right.
You know, and so it's something that we learn. I wouldn't trade one day of my life or my career for all the money they're making now. I mean, it's great, the money, because hindsight, knowing what I know now, would be great to make that money. But I wouldn't change one thing.
Were the personalities as big on that A's team as the stories suggest? Because that team's known not only for talent,
right,
but also for the personalities.
I think the biggest thing, realize that we had one bus, not two, not players on one, staff on the other. We all rode the same bus. We loved getting on each other. And Herb Washington, who was just a pinch runner, he never hit once. The funny thing to see him on a baseball card holding a bat, I said, Herbie, what are you doing holding a bat? You never swung a bat once. And, you know, guys would get on him because you could imagine a track star, and Charlie was very innovative. But, you know, he said, I don't want this guy to be, you know, a pinch runner. But guys would get on him like, who are you? He'd get right back. And Herbie took his World Series checks and turned them into some McDonald's and did a very good job. He was very smart in doing that. But I think mostly it was blown out of proportion because we didn't have media people traveling. We had Jim Street and Ron Bergman, and that was it. They knew everything that was going on. We get to postseason, hey, the A's are fighting. Well, we would create all that stuff. I remember at a game, we were going to Baltimore, I think it was 74, and we were up, it was tied 1-1, and we're on the bus going to the ballpark.
and we started getting on each other. We said, oh, man, the Orioles are in trouble. We ended up winning the next two and went on the World Series. But it was almost like a motivating factor for us. But I will say this. Once the game started, it was, you know, the best teams I ever played on, just because the guys knew how to play. When I was traded, Dick Williams said, we do two things. We pitch and we catch the baseball. That's all we do. We're going to score runs, but pitching and defense will win you games. And here we are many, many years later. It's still the same thing.
In fact, 50th anniversary this year of baseball coming to Oakland after coming from Kansas City. I know a number of celebrations are planned this year. Are you looking forward to seeing some of your old teammates?
Well, as a matter of fact, they have the various reunions based on the championships in the 70s, the 89 World Series. And it's, you know, it's the greatest thing. We have had in the past reunions. And I remember Sal Bando, the captain. I mean, what a great guy. He would say, hey, we have to enjoy these. We may not be alive the next time they have one, you know, because you start getting older. But some of the great times, and I will say this, that we had carpool from Danville, California to Oakland to the Coliseum. It was Joe Rudy, James and Sal Bando, and me. We all rode together all 4 days. And I'll never forget the first time when I got traded. I'm outside with just a polo shirt on, and the guys are laughing at me. They go, what are you? No, everything's fine. Go to the Coliseum. It was freezing. After the game, I said, now I know why you guys were laughing, because they had jackets and I didn't. But, you know, some of the great teams that I've ever played on, and it's great to remember those teams because they were the best. And when you win three world championships, the one thing that upsets me now is to hear a team win a World Series and say, oh, we're tired. We're tired. Give me a break. You play this game for one reason, to be a world champion, to wear a World Series ring. So why do you say in your mind you're tired because you play in October? You still have 4 months off to get ready for the next season. But for this team, the A's, and granted, you know, the motivating factor, maybe Charlie Finley, those guys knew, but Charlie took care of those guys. I mean, he invested for them, guaranteed them no losses. I mean, he did a lot of things that people don't realize, but it was great to play for a team that I knew when we walked out on that field. And you know, Dan, I didn't know until Jason Kendall was with the A's, and something that I never looked at statistics, but the little box in the bio for the player, and it said Jason Kendall onto the side, and it said most consecutive games to start a season behind the plate. I started the first 50 in 1973. In today's world, guys want to, but they won't let them, right? Because, oh, you have to have a day off. Why? Cal Ripken, his record would never be broken. But to start 50 games, but there's your difference of knowing that when you go to the park, you feel like you're going to win. When you lose, you don't want to go to the park. And that's the difference of winning and losing. And I had the experience of losing in Cleveland, right? And I went to Oakland and won, and it was such a beautiful thing.
Well, it's one of the great teams in baseball history from a great era. You were a big part of two of those world championship teams. I appreciate you reminiscing a little bit.
You know, you have the greatest voice in the world, and really, I'm serious. I mean, it's just, I always think about you and just in all sports that you do, so I commend you. Because I enjoy baseball. This is my sport. But I know you do a lot of sports, and you do them excellently. You have a great voice, so congratulations to you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Nice seeing you, as always.
As always, thank you, Dan. Anytime, my friend.
Unfortunately for Ray Fossey, one of the things he is best known for is getting run over by Pete Rose in an All-Star game, which caused him a serious injury that took him a long time to recover from. And after all these years and being asked about it so many times, Ray said, you know what, I've put that behind me. Let's talk about the good memories. So that's where we went with Ray Fossey, and there certainly were a lot of good stories to be told. When we come back, Ben with Tim Leeper, the first base and outfield coach for the Blue Jays.
Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports. Dunks, dives, and deeks. Catch highlights, news, and the best storytelling in Canada. Featuring all the stories you want to read in one place. Plus, exclusive podcasts including 31 Thoughts and At the Letters. Canada's deepest roster of storytellers. Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports.
Joined now by Tim Leeper, first base and outfield coach for the Toronto Blue Jays. Thanks for coming on, Tim. Just wanted to start off, what does a day look like for you? What's your day-to-day routine when you come to the ballpark?
Usually, it depends. If it's like a first game of a series, I'll get here early in the day, and then my job's basically just to go over as much video as I possibly can. So being in charge of the base running in the outfield, like, I'll try to break down every pitcher, what his pickoff moves are, when are they vulnerable in terms of so we can steal a base if we need to, do they bounce breaking balls, stuff like that. So I'll try to, like, watch as many games as I can, watch as many pitches as they throw, and learn as much as I can about them before the players get here. And then I have to get information to the players. And in terms of the outfield stuff, I try to, like, same thing. I watch as much video as I can. And we have a list of or a sheet where guys hit the ball most of the time, but I kind of want to watch, like, their last 10, 15 games, see what they're doing, what adjustments they've made, and then just try to prepare, like, a kind of a blueprint for the players. So when I talk to them before a game and get them ready for the game, I feel like they feel like they've been out there before and they know the hitters. So my job is just to break down all the video that I possibly can and give the information to the players.
So a guy hits a single and he's rounding and he comes out and stops. What are you telling him at first base, preparing him for? Does it depend on the certain pitcher?
Being a first base coach, you have to be really proactive, whereas a third base coach, you're being reactive to plays and you're making decisions. So most of the stuff I do is before the game. So hopefully if it's a pitcher that we can steal a base on, I've already had the conversation with the player. So what I'll do is just remind them of what we talked about earlier so it's not the first time they've heard it. And then before the pitch, just kind of make sure that you kind of set the stage for them, what you think might happen. Like if the outfielders are shifted, if there's holes in the infield, in any way we can get to first and third, I want to, like, let them know before the ball's hit, you know, what to look for, and then, like, hopefully they'll get out of the gates running and we'll get first to third as much as we can.
I want to move back now to closer to your playing career. You spent a lot of time in the Tigers organization. Part of your time with the Tigers was in London with the London Majors. Was that the first time you had ever been in Canada? How was that experience?
It was the first time I was in Canada, and it was great. It was the first year of a team. It was actually really cool. You know, I think it was the first time I ever really saw snow for the first time. Had a really good team. Had a lot of fun there. I remember living I can't remember the name, but we lived in a retirement. Me and Travis Fryman lived in a retirement home downtown London, and we had a really good time there. The people were great. Our travel was brutal. Yeah, that was tough, but it was good to play there, and it gave me my first foray into Canada, and I've lived here probably almost exclusively since then.
Also, moving past your minor league managerial career, you also spent a lot of time with Canada baseball, including the 2004 Olympic team and a couple different World Baseball Classic teams. How did you get into that, and what was the experience like coaching for the entire country of Canada?
That's great. I've done that since like 2003 now, and it's been one of the best experiences of my life. It got me involved in international baseball, which I still do today, and being a part of Baseball Canada, I can't even... I mean, the whole world's opened up to me as a result of that. I mean, best relationships of my life have come from that program. And I got really lucky. I lived in Ottawa. I knew Greg Hamilton, the head of Baseball Canada. And then just one day, and just in a conversation, I kind of offered to help. And he said, I didn't think you were interested. And I told him I was totally interested, but I didn't think I could do it. That's how I got involved. And then the first term I was in was the 2003 Olympic qualifier in Panama. And we qualified for the Olympics. And you know, I got to go to the Olympics in my second year of coaching an international program, which I'd never thought I would do. And, you know, it was the greatest experience of my life. And then, like, doing all the World Baseball Classics, doing all the other tournaments that we've done, the Pan Am Games, being the first Canadian team to win the gold medal in the Pan Am Games, it's been unbelievable. Like, I it's just been a journey that second to none. And the other thing is the relationship with players, the way the Canadian guys all kind of bond, stay together no matter where we are. Can't say enough good about it. It's really shaped who I am and really made a big difference in my life.
Now, wrapping up now, going through your tenure with the Blue Jays, you guys have had some pretty incredible years, including 15 and 16, making the ALCS in back-to-back seasons. What's your favorite moment so far as being a member of the Blue Jays staff and part of the organization?
There's so many. There really is. I mean, obviously the two playoff runs were great. I mean, 15 was special for a lot of reasons, and 16 was even, in some ways, better. It wasn't as easy. But the hard work, and then like to see how we came about, and how we still end up getting the ALCS that year, that was fun. But like, there's so many good moments. I mean, you look at great time. The bat flip game was great. Edwin's walk off home run here in the wild card game was something. And just like being around us and watching us grow like as a team, as an organization, that's been the big thing. I mean, we really struggled in 13. It was my first year here. I was in the minor leagues. And in 14, we were in first place for a good part of the season, but we didn't make the playoffs. But to like kind of go through that process to where you keep getting better, and while you're doing it, seeing the city come alive, and like the stands going from like 20,000 a night to like 45,000 mm-hmm. against Arizona on a Monday and in certain times, like that was really cool to watch, and it was cool to be a part of. And like coming here every day is really fun. Still is really fun, but it was really fun then, and building up to that is what makes it so great.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time. I wish you success and good luck with the rest of the season.
Well, without question, a lot of ground covered on a lot of different topics this week. on A Swing and a Belt. As always, you can reach our producer online, Emil Delich, at AMANDELIC. You can find him on Twitter. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenShulman7. And you can find me at DShulman_ESPN. We'll be back with you again next week. Until then, thanks for listening.
Joe has had his moments. Trying to lay off that ball, low to the outside part of the plate, and he just went after one. Two balls and two strikes on it. Here's the pitch on the way. A swing and a belt. Left field. Way back. Blue Jays win it. The Blue Jays are World Series champions as Joe Carter hits a three-run home run in the ninth inning, and the Blue Jays have repeated as World Series champions. Touch them all, Joe. You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
They said this day would never come. Here is something none of my predecessors ever got a chance to say. Welcome to the White House, the World Series champion, Chicago Cubs. I know you guys would prefer to stand the whole time, but sit down. I will say to the Cubs, it took you long enough. I mean, I've only got 4 days left. You're just making another run. David Ross and I have something in common. We've both been on a year-long retirement party. But unlike Grandpa, my team has not yet brought me a scooter with a motorized golf caddy, but there are 4 days left. Maybe I'll get that.